Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Derek Shearer, former United States Ambassador to Finland, and director and founder of the International and Public Affairs Center at the Occidental College in Los Angeles. Dr. Shearer's topic will be the United States foreign policy in Afghanistan. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 28, 2009, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the College of St. Mary, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Christine Farr, Vice President for Academic Affairs at the College of St. Mary.
Derek is an expert on foreign affairs and public policy. He has published and lectured extensively, both in the United States and abroad. This evening, he's going to speak to us about Afghanistan and world politics, and I believe that he's going to address some of the issues that the Obama administration faces in this realm. I'm really delighted to present to you our Woodrow Wilson scholar, Derek Shearer. Thank you, Derek.
Well, thank you very much, Christine. It's a pleasure for my wife, Sue, and I to be here at the College of St. Mary. What I wanted to do tonight is frame for you the decision that President Obama is going to be making probably within the next week, a decision about war and peace, a decision about deploying young American men and women overseas, and a decision that will probably be his most significant in his first year, perhaps his most significant in his first term as president. And I'm not going to second guess him, as it were, although when we have question and discussion, I'm happy to talk a bit more about what I might think or you might think should be done. What I want to try and do is wear my professorial hat and use what knowledge I have of how Washington operates to explain to you how he might be looking at this decision and how it is being debated currently in Washington, D.C. Now, for presidents, decisions about war and peace are among the most difficult, and they're often the most fraught with domestic political consequences. We know from recent American political history that it is often more difficult for a Democratic president to make these decisions than a Republican president. There are domestic political pressures on Democrats to be tough, to show that they can decide to use military power, that they can stand up to America's enemies. Republicans often don't have to prove that, and it sometimes gives them more room to do things in foreign affairs than Democrats. And I'll just give you a few examples. When President Eisenhower was candidate Eisenhower running against Adlai Stevenson, and the Korean War was going on, and the incumbent Harry Truman was being criticized because he had not won the war. In fact, he had fired General MacArthur, who in the eyes of many people wanted to win the war, to take it across the Chinese border and have a decisive victory. And Adlai Stevenson was criticized, egghead, more of a peacenik. Eisenhower was obviously a general. And Eisenhower campaigned on the fact that he would go to Korea. He didn't say what he would do when he would get there, but he said he would go there. Ultimately, he made a peace. He didn't win a victory in Korea. There's still an ongoing armistice. North and South Korea are still divided today. But somehow, for Republican and former General Eisenhower, politically, he had the space to end a conflict without victory in a way that perhaps a Democrat would not have. During the Cold War, Democrats were always seen as somehow being a little soft on communism or not willing to stand up to the Russians or the Chinese. And if you go back and look at this interesting history of the Vietnam War, which was displayed in great detail in a study that Robert McNamara had the Pentagon do called the Pentagon Papers. Some of you may are old enough to remember that it was a man named Daniel Ellsberg who was one of the analysts who worked on these papers at the Rand Corporation in Santa Monica and then released the papers to the New York Times. And what the papers were really all about was a study in presidential decision making, about decisions that a succession of presidents made about American involvement in Vietnam. And one of the most interesting facts that came out of these studies is that Democratic presidents, even though they might have privately thought the war wasn't the right thing to do or the war wasn't going well, didn't want to be seen to lose a war. And this was a great fear of Lyndon Johnson. He didn't want to be attacked for having lost the Vietnam War. Richard Nixon, of course, ran as the candidate who had a plan to end the war in victory, peace with victory. And the peacenik George McGovern, even though he had been a decorated bomber pilot in World War II, was somehow seen as someone who would cave in and not succeed in Vietnam. Of course, Nixon gets elected. He makes a peace without victory. Vietnam gets taken over by our so-called enemies, the communists. And the man who negotiated the peace without victory, Henry Kissinger, is awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. So there's interesting dynamics at work in American politics. And this is important to remember when we think about President Obama sitting in the White House making a decision about increasing American troop strength in Afghanistan. Because, as some of you are already aware, he is already being criticized by his Republican opponents for dithering. He's taking too much time. He is encouraging our enemies around the world because he doesn't seem to be decisive because he has not accepted his general's recommendations for more troops. So this dynamic of American history goes on even today. But the setting, of course, is different. It's a different war, different president. What's interesting to me when I'm wearing my analytical hat is that during the campaign, Barack Obama was seen as the more peace-loving or kind of peacenik, more diplomatic candidate, certainly in the primaries against Mrs. Clinton, when she criticized him for wanting to talk to our enemies, and there was a famous ad you may have seen, the red phone ad, who would answer the phone in the middle of night and obviously then order some attack. She was tougher than he was, even though she was a woman. Of course, he wins. And when he campaigned, people weren't, I find now, when I talk about it with students and with people who remember the campaign, they don't remember his words exactly. I had a student come up to me today, earlier, when I was speaking about issues related to Afghanistan and say, didn't Obama say he would bring the troops home and end the war? And I said, well, yes, he said that about Iraq. He didn't say that about Afghanistan. And if you were listening closely, what he said was that Iraq was the wrong war. Iraq was a dumb war. It was a strategic mistake on the part of the United States. But in fact, Afghanistan was the right war. And I found, I do some lecturing around the world for the State Department, and when my wife Sue and I were in Australia during the campaign, and I would point this out to Australian officials, and they would say, oh, well, Obama's going to withdraw the troops. And I said, yeah, from Iraq, but he's going to come to you, Australians, and say, we want you to up your troop strength in Afghanistan. And I told some of my German and French colleagues, I said, he's going to be coming back to you because in his point of view, Afghanistan is the right place to exercise American military power. And so if you'd been paying attention to the campaign, you wouldn't be surprised that when he took office, one of his first steps that, again, didn't get a lot of notice was that he replaced the existing general in Afghanistan and put in a new general named Stanley McChrystal. And General McChrystal is a protege and ally of General David Petraeus, who'd been President Bush's favorite general and who'd been in charge of the war in Iraq. And Petraeus and McChrystal have a particular view about the role of the army, about how you use American force, and about a doctrine called counterinsurgency, which I'll come back to in a minute. But it should not be a surprise to President Obama that the man he appointed to head up the military effort in Afghanistan would come back to him with a request for troops to carry out a strategy of counterinsurgency in Afghanistan. A few months after Obama made this decision to replace the generals, he gave a speech in which he said, "The war in Afghanistan, unlike the war in Iraq, is not a war of choice. It's a war of necessity." And by that he meant it is necessary to engage in this war to protect the national security of the United States, in his opinion as president and commander-in-chief. A war of necessity, not a war of choice. Some people, when he said this, argued, debated, was that really true? But it seemed pretty clear, since he'd given a major speech, that that was his point of view. So, new general, new doctrine of counterinsurgency, war of necessity. Over the summer, things don't seem to be going too well in Afghanistan, and it's not surprising because this is a country that has been subjected to the vagaries of history and interventions by other forces beyond their control. As you know, if you know some of the history of the area, Afghanistan had a fairly stable monarchy, constitutional monarchy and government. It was a kind of peaceful, tribally oriented society in the 1970s when the Soviet Union invaded and took over the country and installed a pro-Soviet communist government. Not a very nice thing to happen to the people of Afghanistan. In response, the U.S. government financed and supported an insurgency against the Soviet forces. We reached out to Mujahideen and jihadist forces around the world, including Osama bin Laden and people who later made up al-Qaeda, and said, "We want you to fight the Russians. This is part of the Cold War. This is really cool. We'll help you guys defeat the Soviet forces." And they became our allies. The Chinese were even our allies in that war. The Chinese secretly helped send military support via Pakistan, using the Pakistan Secret Service, to support the Mujahideen and insurgency against the Soviet Union. The reason we did that is because we were then in the Cold War, although the last days. And from our framework at the time, anything bad that happened to the Soviet Union was good for us. And we didn't really pay that much attention to the folks whom we were paying or giving support, militaries, to fight them. That was kind of an afterthought, that maybe somehow we should focus on exactly who these guys are that we've made a deal with. But we did a lot of that in the Cold War. You know, if you were against the Russians, then you were on our side and didn't mean anything, and if you happened to be not the nicest guy in the world. And we didn't particularly care about Afghanistan because Afghanistan was just a surrogate war for this larger war, the Cold War. And in many ways, that's what Vietnam was. It was a surrogate war between the superpowers because the two nuclear powers could not actually fight a real war because that would be a nuclear holocaust. The war in Afghanistan ends, and it helps to weaken the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union ultimately collapses internally and through its own contradictions, its own lack of economic success, and the Cold War ends. And we proclaim that we're in a new era of peace and economic advancement. It's used the general title of globalization. And Tom Friedman, the New York Times foreign affairs columnist, writes a famous book called The Lexus and the Olive Tree, which says the new frame for international affairs is not the Cold War, it's globalization. Everybody now is part of the marketplace. liberal democracy and market economy has triumphed. It's a new world. We're all going to advance together. Didn't last very long, this period. We and the rest of the international community didn't pay much attention to Afghanistan. A group of young students, using the name Taliban, which means students, decided that they would be reformers in their own country, overthrew what they viewed as corrupt warlords, and set up a government in Afghanistan, the government of Pakistan, a kind of ally of ours, supported them in creating this new Afghanistan under what we call a nationalist Islamic movement. The Taliban was not going to use Afghanistan to attack us or attack Pakistan, attack anyone else. They just wanted to run their own country, and they've got this particular conservative view of Islam about how to run it. They don't treat women very well. They don't have a high regard for art. But they weren't the enemy of the United States. And in fact, we had, under the Clinton administration, fairly friendly relationship with the Taliban. But then 9/11 happens. And the U.S. is attacked on its own home soil by terrorists. Now, those of you who followed that event know that 2/3 of the terrorists were actually Saudis, a country in which we are allied with, not at war with. And we can talk about reasons why this was done, or what the strategy of Osama bin Laden, who was the mastermind behind the attack, had in mind. But it was not a military attack on the United States. It was not a country with an army saying, we are attacking the United States in the way that the Empire of Japan attacked us on December 7th, 1941, as part of World War II. It was what I call a symbolic attack. It was something terrorists were doing to strike at what they saw as the twin pillars of this era of globalization, which they don't like. So they're going to attack the commerce, the Twin Towers, the symbol of capitalism. They're going to attack the Pentagon, the symbol of American military might. And they tried but were unsuccessful to attack the symbol of liberal democracy, the U.S. Capitol. But they were not invading the United States, and they were not declaring war because they had no country and they had no army. President Bush's response to 9/11 was, I believe, a strategic error in the way that he did it. He declared a war on terror, a kind of new Cold War in which you could divide up the world now, not between communist and non-communist, but between those who were with us against terror and terrorists and those who were against us and didn't support us. And there was no middle ground. Now, obviously, Afghanistan, under the Taliban, while they had not been our political enemy, had supported and provided physical space for Osama bin Laden to operate. And we asked them to give him over to us, and they refused. And we quite rightly decided to go into that country and try to remove the people who'd attacked us. We did that with very limited military force. We sent in some CIA teams who provided air support to what was called the Northern Alliance. So, again, not nice people, but they were sided with us, warlords, to overthrow the Taliban government in Kabul and try and capture or kill Osama bin Laden's supporters. And many of them fled into the borderlands between Pakistan in Afghanistan. And it was a very successful, in many ways, limited military operation. Almost no American casualties, no large American military footprint. But then we shifted our attention to Iraq. And I won't go through all the history, but as you know, Iraq was somehow put in the same category as Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden is a threat to the United States, And so much so that majority of Americans actually thought that Saddam Hussein had ordered the 9/11 attack on New York, which was not the case. We invaded Iraq, a country that had not attacked us, and engaged in a very significant and still ongoing military operation in that country, and took our eye off the ball or limited our attention on Afghanistan. And that's why when President Obama was campaigning as a candidate, he said the decision to go into Iraq was a strategic mistake. It empowered Iran. It created more terrorists than it killed by being a propaganda coup for Osama bin Laden, and that we had neglected Afghanistan and we had let the Taliban grow back in strength. And, of course, we'd not captured Osama bin Laden. You could say that was a reasonable critique. And Obama was pretty clear that when he was president, he was going to do it differently. And as I've suggested, he started to take those steps. We come up to today, and the president, and we want to give him credit for this, is having some second thoughts about his initial decisions. Were they the right ones? Is this the right general? Do we really want to engage in an all-out counterinsurgency strategy in the country of Afghanistan? A full, what's called counterinsurgency strategy, which this means that you put troops into a country to make it more secure, and at the same time, you win over the hearts and minds of the population by treating them well, by making them more secure, by building roads, by educating their women. You, in effect, build a nation at the same time that you defeat the bad guys. Now, the standard army manual for counterinsurgency that David Petraeus wrote gives a ratio of troops to population, about 50-1, that you need. If we followed that standard ratio in Afghanistan, we would need about 600,000 troops to be placed in that country for upwards of 10 years. That's just following Petraeus and Army doctrine. Now, politically, President Obama, when faced with that, going down that road, which General McChrystal's request for an additional 40,000 troops was not just 40,000 and stopped there, but this is a step forward. And the military, told to plan for a counterinsurgency strategy, has been working out plans and programs to say, well, over the next 10 years, we can retrain the Afghan army, we can fix their schools, we can nation build. But President Obama suddenly, I think, thought, given all the other things I want to do as president, and also the other range of threats facing the United States and problems, maybe this is not the direction I want to take the country. So he has instituted a rethink, shorthand, for a consideration of his options, which his opponents call dithering. But what he has done, and this is one of the things you're learning about our president, he's very methodical. He likes a lot of discussion. He likes to hear from his advisors. He has had over 7 meetings with the Joint Chiefs of Staff on Afghanistan. He has had his senior advisory team that includes the Secretary of Defense, Secretary Clinton, special envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, Richard Holbrooke, into the White House for very extensive meetings and discussions about what he wants to do in Afghanistan. And he has not yet announced his decision, although we are getting some indications through leaks. We're also starting to get an interesting debate and discussion about the decision itself from what we'll call interested parties, the public, historians, politicians, and I'll just give you a flavor of how that debate is being framed, because some of it's very interesting because it goes back to the Vietnam War. There are 2 books that came out in recent months that have been passed around in Washington. One is a study of decision-making, President Kennedy's presidency, about Vietnam. And the book basically argues that Kennedy did not really carefully examine all the options about Vietnam. He didn't really test the assumption that Vietnam, if it went communist, would be a falling domino and all the rest of Asia would follow, which was one of the arguments in favor of being in Vietnam. Didn't really thoroughly think out what our strategy was. So that book, if you read that, and Rahm Emanuel, the president's chief of staff, was known to be reading it, would argue for this dithering, this careful consideration, rethink, a drawing back to say, well, maybe the initial assumptions of this is the war of necessity aren't correct. Maybe it isn't a war of necessity, or maybe it's not that much of a necessity. There's another book by a former military officer that says the Vietnam War was winnable if only the politicians had listened to the generals. The generals had finally worked out a workable strategy to win the war in Vietnam, and it was the politicians who didn't have the political courage and the public, that nasty, you know, thing that happens in democracy, and the press, who were disloyal to the government and who raised all these questions, the anti-war movement, evil Seymour Hersh, the investigative reporter who wrote about My Lai. These were the bad guys. They undermined the political will, and these weak politicians caved in, and we lost the war in Vietnam. So that's another argument, and that's the argument that supports listen to the generals. Do what McChrystal wants. Follow what Petraeus, because they know. It's like a professional decision. It's not political. And that's a very strong line that's being argued about what Obama ought to do. This time, listen to your generals. And I find it really interesting that we go back to that Vietnam argument. We almost never lose the argument, and maybe my generation will never. You'll constantly be fighting over Vietnam, you know, until we all die. But it's interesting that that's one of the ways it's being talked about. The other way that it's being talked about is to seriously rethink the war on terror. President Obama started to do that. He told his administration, we don't want to use the word war on terror, because terror is not a nation, it's not a person. Terror is a tactic which has been used throughout history. It's like, how can you declare war on a tactic? It's no end to it. It's an endless war. Some people call it the long war, but it doesn't have any end because you don't have, it's not clear who the enemy is and when you've defeated them. And so Obama got some of that, and he also wanted to make clear that this is not a war on Islam. And he's been very good about that. He gave a significant speech in Egypt in which he made it quite clear that this is not a war on Islam. It is not a clash of civilizations, as so many had argued during the Bush administration. That the actual folks we can classify as terrorists are a very small extremist group relative to lighter, larger forces in the society. And he got a lot of credit around the world for doing that. If you look at public opinion polls about Barack Obama, in almost every country, they're extremely high right now. And one of the reasons I believe that he won the Nobel Peace Prize, although many people said he hasn't done anything yet, is because the men who were deciding about the Nobel Peace Prize wanted to reward Americans. All you voters in the congressional district in Omaha who voted for Barack Obama, that wanted to say to the American people, you elected Barack Obama, a man of peace, not a unilateralist, a man who understands it's not a clash of civilizations. And even though he hasn't really made the tough decisions or made peace anywhere, he is talking the talk, and you Americans selected him, and we want to congratulate you. And that the Nobel, I believe, Peace Prize was not really given to Barack Obama. it was given to the American people in a hopeful way, like, we hope this is who you chose, the kind of person, and we hope this will be the outcome. So at the moment, Obama has a very high standing around, probably higher in many countries than he has at home. And it's going to be very interesting to see, as he makes the decision about Afghanistan, whether that's going to change international public perception of him, because I've traveled a lot around the world and given lectures, and I often have to remind people that the President of the United States is not the President of the world. In effect, you kind of think he is, because we're the most powerful nation. But the rest of the world doesn't get to vote. I've had students, you know, like in Syria, say, why couldn't we vote for Obama? I said, you know, it's our country. He's the President of the United States. He's not the President of the world. But there are expectations that the world has put on Obama, which are incredible. And how he uses that and how they're affected by Afghanistan, I think is going to be incredibly, incredibly interesting. We all have to remember that he is an elected politician as well as a world leader. And he has to worry about domestic politics. He has to worry about votes in the Senate and the House on other things in his agenda. And he has to worry about domestic critics who matter much more to him than international public opinion. So these are all forces weighing on him as he is sitting in these final days in the White House trying to decide what he's going to do about Afghanistan. And it's going to be, I think, very telling as to what he decides, but even more important, how he explains it to the American people. Because right now, public opinion is both very divided but very soft about Afghanistan. A small majority of the people don't want to send more troops. A minority, but not insignificant number, say send more troops, but they don't feel very strongly about the matter. We don't have a draft, so most families don't have their kids going involuntarily. Military families are very respectful of what a president decides and tend to follow the commander-in-chief, so it's not like there's a revolt in the military ranks yet about this issue. And it tends to be in foreign affairs that the public does follow the president. They tend to think the president knows best about protecting the national interests. And I suspect that if Obama makes a clear decision and then explains it, and he does give a good speech and explains it clearly why he's doing this, that he'll probably win over, at least in the short run, public opinion at home. The larger question, of course, is will the decision he makes have longer run consequences that might come back to affect his presidency? And we don't absolutely know that yet because we don't know what he's going to decide. But I think, and it's a great time if you're a student of the president or you care about these kind of international issues, over the next week or two, you're going to see them played out in public in a way that's what Obama likes to call a teachable moment. And there are all these subplots and stories that make it very rich, and I'll just give you a few examples today that happened just in the last day or two that make it even more fascinating. Today's New York Times has a wonderful story, brother of Afghan leader said to be paid by the CIA. Well, it turns out that Ahmed Karzai, our ally and president, not only did he stuff the ballot box in the recent UN elections, you can understand the guy wanted to get reelected, and it's a lot of difficulty running elections in a country at war, so, you know, if you can't actually have people vote, why not put in the votes for yourself? That created a little political problem for President Obama because it didn't look like we had a government in place. It was a problem President Kennedy had in Vietnam. You know, the various presidents of Vietnam didn't look like they were such great allies. Well, now somebody leaks to the New York Times that the president's brother is being paid by the CIA, and he also happens, perhaps, to be a drug runner, you know, and a gangster. But he's our guy, because he rents out his property to the CIA and our special forces. He's their landlord. So it makes for a kind of wonderfully rich story about who we have to get in bed with in this part of the world, because there are no really good guys, to maybe protect our country or to follow our national security. But it also makes the job of the president a little more difficult to explain. In the Washington Post yesterday, the highest ranking Foreign Service officer to yet quit over Afghanistan announced his resignation as a young man who was actually a decorated Marine commander. After he left the Marine Forces, he joined the State Department, became an expert on reconstruction in Afghanistan, worked on projects. Everyone praised this young man. And yesterday in the Washington Post, his letter was released that he had written to the president explaining why he was resigning, because he does not believe that our military presence in Afghanistan is in the interest of the U.S., that the president has not explained why we were there. It doesn't make any sense to him. It seems counterproductive. He spelled all this in a letter. And the White House and the State Department were so nervous by this one single junior officer that Richard Holbrooke brought him in for meetings. Holbrooke offered him a job back on his team in the State Department. He had meetings with the vice president's national security advisor, like, couldn't we change your mind? They didn't. It appeared in the Post front page. So you could say giving support to some of the congressmen and senators who aren't in favor of increasing the troops. And in a way, these kinds of leaks are part of the decision-making game and the forces that any president had to deal with. There was an earlier leak, some of you may remember, General McChrystal's report. The request for 40,000 more troops was leaked to Bob Woodward of the Washington Post, a standard recipient of big-time leaks, put on the front page of the Post, and the whole point seemed to be that the pro-increase the troop forces wanted to put pressure on Obama by publicizing McChrystal's recommendation so that then the conservative critics of Obama could say, look, the general wants to do his job, here's his report, do his job. So there have been wonderful leaks on both sides, which, again, if you're teaching political science or international affairs, it's wonderful material. But it also shows you the nuanced and complicated environment in which an American president has to operate. It's not simply go to war against those who attacked us or don't go to war. What will Obama do? Well, I'd like to hear from you and your predictions, and I'm happy in discussion and back and forth to give you my suggestion or where the evidence might suggest where he's going to go, but also to hear from you about what you think he ought to do and what are the consequences of those particular paths and how you feel. Is this a war of necessity or a war of choice? Thank you very much.
We have a microphone here, so if you'd like to speak, please just raise your hand and I'll bring it around to you.
Could you describe, in your vision, if we moved out militarily, what happens to the people of Afghanistan?
Well, that's a good question. And you can also ask, you know, what happens to the people of Afghanistan if we stay. Now, remember, when we say people, the Taliban are the people of Afghanistan, too. These are not foreigners. These are native residents, former rulers of the country in many regards. So part of the answer is we don't know entirely what exactly would happen, because even if we did move out or lessen our military presence, we wouldn't do it overnight, just as we're not doing it in Iraq. We would do it in some progression. That's an important consideration, of course. Do we have a moral obligation somehow to protect Afghanistan, in a sense, against itself, against its own civil strife? Did we have that same responsibility for Iraq? It's a good question. One point of view, which I recommend to you, that's why I brought the New York Times, because they're all displayed, Tom Friedman, who supported the war in Iraq, if you read his column today in the New York Times, he says the consequences of leaving won't be so bad. In fact, we all say they'll be terrible on the day after we leave, but then you go to the day after, and it actually turns out that the predictions of terrible things happening don't, and that often by us backing away, people in their own countries start to resolve their own issues. And he gives some examples in his column that our presence sometimes hinders the solution of these problems. Now, the situation in Afghanistan is complicated by the fact that our ally, Pakistan, is also part of the problem. They support some of the forces that we're fighting at the same time that they're fighting some of their own internal battles, and they also keep a lot of their military aimed at India, even though we're allied with India as well. So you could also say, what is the responsibility of Pakistan to what goes on in Afghanistan, or what is the responsibility of the international community? NATO is also there, and I didn't even mention those complications. It's a very fraught political issue in Germany about German troops being involved in Afghanistan. The Dutch parliament voted last week to remove their troops from Afghanistan. The new government in Japan seems to be pulling away from even the minor support of refueling our ships in the sea on the way to Afghanistan. On the other hand, Britain announces they're going to be with us. They want to support the increase in the troops. It is a war of necessity. So NATO itself is split about this decision. But I think the honest answer is that we don't know exactly what would happen. It might be better. It might be worse. It probably won't be one of the two extremes. A lot of the groups that are called the Taliban are local groups whose concerns are local and tribal. They're not aimed at us. They're actually, by our own military's assessment, by President's National Security Advisor, General Jim Jones, about 100 al-Qaeda members in the Afghan-Pakistan area. 100. Okay, that's not a lot. We have 60,000 troops right now. It seems to some people, 60,000 armed troops, 100 guys who have no airplanes or helicopters, can't we deal with them at that level? Now, maybe the Taliban aren't the best folks, but are they our enemy, or are there segments of the Taliban that we can cut deals with? What we did in Iraq was to cut deals with people who'd been our enemy. There were a lot of Sunni insurgents and militants who'd been killing Americans. We cut a deal with them, paid them money, brought them over to our camp, and said, we'll be supportive of your rights against the Shia majority if you stop fighting us. And one of the ways that the violence, relatively speaking, in Iraq has been reduced is because we were willing to make those kind of deals with not such good guys. Could we cut some deals with warlords or Taliban in Afghanistan at the same time protect the major population senators? There's some indication about how that might happen. Again, an article in the New York Times today, a suggestion that the president doesn't have to decide for the counterinsurgency strategy, or what's called the counterterrorism strategy that Vice President Biden's been arguing for, a pullback of the military forces, but using your special forces and our predators just to go after al-Qaeda, the 100 or so. maybe there's a kind of hybrid model where we don't dramatically increase our troops. We protect the major population centers in the country, so we don't allow terrible things to happen to a lot of people. But we still go after some of the really, really bad guys who don't want to cut a deal, and we try and cut a deal with the rest. There's no good option here. Because remember, too, when we have a full military presence, we kill a lot of civilians. We have a list, for example, right now. Our military has a list of suspected drug dealers that our military is empowered to kill without due process. Now, who gets on that list? Well, we know from the Vietnam War, when we had a similar program called Operation Phoenix, is that often, you know, you or I, as locals, might say, God, I don't like my neighbor. He's a rival. So I'm going to put him on the bad guys list, and we'll let the Americans take care of him for me. I mean, because, you know, there's no due process here about whether you're on the enemy's list or not. The German troops called in an airstrike a few weeks ago, killed over 100 innocent women and children. Well, call it collateral damage. In Iraq, not only were 500,000 Iraqis killed, 1 million Iraqis were turned into refugees and driven out of their own country. And I saw some of them soon. I saw them firsthand. You go to Syria, there are a lot of refugees living there. What's happened to the women? Well, they're not allowed to work in Syria. The only jobs they're allowed to have are prostitutes and pole dancers. And there's a whole highway going out of Damascus where rich Saudis and Gulfy men come to pay to use Iraqi refugee women. I mean, that's a cost of a military invasion, too. So this is a part of the world where you're trying to find the least worst outcome. I don't think there's an ideal one.
When you started talking, I thought, well, Obama's going to elect to go ahead and give McChrystal 40,000 troops. But then as you went on, I thought, maybe he's not going to. I heard on BBC last night an interview with a British insider, and according to him, or maybe I read this in the Times, according to what he's saying, the indications are that Obama's going to give the go-ahead for 40,000 more troops. Now, are you saying that once that's done, if that's done, we're in for 600,000 or another decade or more certainly? That's one question. I suppose that's enough to start.
Okay,
with.
Well, let me start. What I was saying was that under the original Crystal report, and the military thinking, not unreasonably, that the president had endorsed, as I say, this counterinsurgency strategy, which takes a long time and requires a lot of troops and a lot of money and a lot of people, that could be a logical assumption were he to say, thank you, General McChrystal, you're my guy, and we're going to do this. Because the more troops you put in, the more pressure there then is to do more. Well, if 40,000 pacified Kandahar, or Helmand province, just think what another 40 could, and as I say, the doctrine to really do this is 600,000 at a minimum for the whole country. So I'm not saying that's what the president's going to do. In fact, I don't think that's what he'll do. But that was the logical conclusion that you could make from the arguments that McChrystal and Petraeus are making. And in fact, they're quite honest about it. They're saying, you know, if you view the Taliban, not just Al-Qaeda, as our enemy, and if you want to rebuild the nation of Afghanistan and make sure it's secure and wait until its government and its military kind of grows up and can take care of themselves, it's going to take 500,000 foreign troops in 10 years. That's kind of the formula. That's reality. But once that kind of sunk in, I think, to the president and the White House, that's where they started to rethink this. They're not sure they want to spend that money, that commitment, that time. because now they're thinking maybe the Taliban is not the enemy. Maybe it's just these 100 Al-Qaeda guys, more or less, and that we can find another way. And the hint, I think, you're getting of what Obama may well decide or announce is also in the New York Times today. And again, this is where people are kind of starting to leak their points of view and their strategy. It's U.S. Ways, Afghan strategy of protecting population hubs. And it's being described as Joe Biden for the countryside, which is the counterterrorism. Let the bad guys stay in the countryside, but if they're really bad guys, hit them with special forces and predators, drones. And kind of counterinsurgency light for the cities, protect the people in the cities, and try and aid and develop the governments of the major cities, and kind of hope for the best that over time this will work out and it won't, you know, go south on the president. That's not Rory. You mean Rory Stewart? That's no. Rory Stewart, some of you may know, he's a British former official in Iraq and also travel writer, quite an intelligent guy. Stewart was much more in the get out camp now, that the military footprint of the United States in NATO causes more problems in these countries than it solves. And that's kind of the line that Tom Friedman is taking in his column, what I'll call the Rory Stewart or the anti-imperial point of view. But as I say, I think what Obama is going to do, or at least there's a lot of hint at it, is what we call a hybrid. He's going to keep Joe Biden, his vice president, and the senators who want him to focus on Al-Qaeda and not go full counterinsurgency on board. And he's going to keep McChrystal and the generals on board by maybe increasing, and I don't know, I'm guessing, let's say 10 or 20, but not 40,000. So there'll be some increase, but not the full increase. And there'll probably be some metrics, like we will do this for X amount of time. And if Karzai can't get his act together, and if it looks just totally hopeless, then we're going to start to withdraw. It's not forever. It's not a forever war. We're going to put conditions on how long we do this. That would be my guess from the evidence we've seen so far. So then, if that's the case, in a sense, Obama's not going towards either camp, he then, as a communicator, is going to have to explain this to the American public, why he's still going to stay in Afghanistan with military force, but how he's going to limit it in a certain way and do other things, and explain this in such a way that he's not attacked from his left or his right in too extreme a political fashion. So it's going to be a real test of his political communications abilities. So that's, you know, if I had to bet today, that's what you'll see in a few days, is that kind of decision, how he explains it, or in Washington parlance, spins it, or what the narrative is, I can't quite tell you. My contributions to some of his earlier speeches were all a while ago, and I'm not in that loop anymore. So I'll be as surprised as the next person to watch the speech. I'll make my students do it.
I still don't think that anybody in the administration has, or the previous administration, has done a good job of really selling the reason why we are in Afghanistan or Iraq. Just tell me, if you can, what do we win if we win in Afghanistan? And what do we lose or win in Iraq if we win or lose in Iraq? I still don't know what we're fighting for in either place.
Well, you see, I think you've spelled out, you know, the political problem for the president of the United States. Now, the previous administration had an argument about what they were fighting for, and they were quite clear about it. They were going to create, in the Middle East, a democratic model country in Iraq that would then set off a chain reaction, a kind of reverse to the domino theory of the Cold War, that Iraq would be a democratic model, and that would force Syria and Iran and all these other countries, their public would demand to be as wonderful a place as Iraq. Now, that was their explanation, and they made it in public. It didn't actually work out that way. You know, it didn't turn out to be an accurate depiction of what happened, and it didn't work. So there was an explanation. It just politically, it was totally unsuccessful, and that's one of the reasons why the president, previous president, and his policy lost public support, because the explanation seemed so at variance with reality, at least in terms of Iraq. Now, on Afghanistan, people haven't focused that much attention on it. They do remember, you know, sort of vaguely, that actually it wasn't Saddam Hussein who attacked us, it was Osama bin Laden, and didn't he have a base in Afghanistan, and that he hasn't been caught yet. So maybe we should catch him and catch some of those bad guys. But I think there's a lot of confusion about this whole thing of, should we nation build in Afghanistan? And you'll hear a lot of people say, you know, maybe we had a nation build at home. You know, we have 10% unemployment, we haven't figured out the health care thing, we got a lot of issues here, why are we doing it there? So you've actually described, in a sense, the political problem for Obama, because the public is confused about why we're there and what we're trying to do, and he's going to have to explain it in a way that maintains at least 51 kind of percent for his actions. But it also may be the case, this is what Tom Friedman argues, that we really shouldn't be there in the way that we are there. And there is a larger argument here, and I'll just stop with this because I think it's useful for you to think on it, which is, what is the source of American power in the world? Is it our military, which is generally what we've been relying on recently? Or is it our values, our way of life, or a model, that we're a model country that other people should follow, and that come here as students, study us, or we'll be happy to share with you, but we're not going to make you do it the way we do it? I mean, what is the source of American power? You know, is it force? Is it persuasion? Is it a mix? And this is kind of what Obama is trying to figure out himself. Yeah, dollars too. But and one of the, as I say, we'll come back and end with the Nobel Prize. I think that the Norwegians who made that decision were saying the best of America, the America they think well of, was the America that used military force only as a last resort when attacked. And in fact, use your good diplomatic means, your economic assistance, and your haven for people and immigrants, your vision of a multicultural, diverse society. That's the America, you know, we kind of hope Barack Obama's going to head. But we don't know, so we'll give you the Peace Prize, and then we're going to cross our fingers. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the College of St. Mary on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Derek Shearer, former United States Ambassador to Finland, and director and founder of the International and Public Affairs Center at Occidental College in Los Angeles. Dr. Shearer's topic was United States Foreign Policy in Afghanistan. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday evening, October 28, 2009, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Carmen Steele, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the College of St. Mary, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.